Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Don and Dude.
Everybody gather around. It's story time. This is the Album Nerds Podcast. I'm Dude. I got Don with me. Don, we're going to get literary. We're going to be smart as we talk about literary albums. How you doing?
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was, all right, never mind.
Are you making that up on the fly? That's beautiful. I think that could be a bestseller.
We're going highbrow today.
What was that? Two Cities thing?
Yes.
All right.
Yeah. Garfield 2, The Tale of Two Kitties.
That is a beautiful story. It's all about love and lasagna. All right, so this is the Album Nerds Podcast. We love albums. We love albums, the album format and finding ways to talk about them. We have a great show for you today. We're going to be each presenting an album that has literary ties, ties to novels, books, highbrow stuff. Don's going to ask us a deep question. Then we're going to have some shout outs to some other albums and album related items we're digging, new releases, that kind of thing. And then, of course, we're going to spin the wheel of musical discovery to find out what we'll be talking about next time. But this week, it's all about literature.
Read a good book or something.
That's what I'm talking about!
Many music albums have drawn inspiration directly from classic works of literature, transforming novels, poems, and plays into new sonic experiences. Musicians often borrow stories, characters, or big ideas from books, finding creative ways to reinterpret them for listeners while bringing a fresh perspective to familiar tales. Today, we will each present an album inspired by literature.
Indeed. See, I'm already sounding smarter. There's quite a few to consider, and then some are loose, like one song, or it's kind of hard to find things that are just straight up the book, which we don't have to do here. But some that came to mind immediately was Mastodon's Leviathan, but we just talked about Mastodon. Yeah. It's inspired by Moby Dick by Herman Melville. This album was discussed a while back on the show as well, so I didn't go in that direction, of course. Iced Earth, metal band. It's called The Dark Saga. It was based on Todd McFarlane's Spawn comics. Okay. I'm not really a comic book guy, but I think it's kind of interesting that it exists. It's heavy, conceptual, but not really well known and maybe a little hard to grasp if you're not a Spawn fan. Yeah. And then on the slower side of things, I really was close on this one. Bruce Springsteen, The Ghost of Tom Joad. Tom Joad being a character in The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck. And it's a folk Americana vibe. Not really as full of sound as I was hoping for this particular discussion, but it's a great album by Bruce Springsteen.
What year was that? Do you remember?
It was 1995, and so it was very much not grasping for modern 1995 sounds, that's for sure. It was Bruce being Bruce. What about you, Don? What pages tickled your fancy?
Well, as you said, there's a lot out there and many like within my wheelhouse. One of the first things I thought of was The Cure 17 Seconds from 1980. What? Yeah, there's a particular song on there called At Night that's inspired by a Franz Kafka story of the same name. Morrissey.
Mm-hmm. More like Borrissey.
We've done The Smiths' Queen is Dead before, you know, which had Oscar Wilde references. Vauxhall and I from 1994, you know, has the opening cut, Now My Heart is Full, has references to Graham Greene's Brighton Rock. It's got another Melville title, Billy Budd, Sailor.
Yeah. Yeah, you see, you're saying all these things, none of which are familiar.
Oh, okay. I think they were only familiar to me because of Morrissey, I guess.
That's kind of the point, right?
Yeah, yeah. And of course, Roger Waters, had to throw him in there. His concept album, Amused to Death, was inspired by Neil Postman's book, Amusing Ourselves to Death. But I didn't choose any of those, so I kind of spared you and the listener.
Thank you. Very much appreciated. All right, the picks are in. Our library cards have been revoked. Let's get to our cha-cha-cha choices.
You choose me?
So my literary pick comes from 1976. It's the debut album from the Alan Parsons Project.
We shall call it the Alan Parsons Project.
All right, so the Alan Parsons Project features Alan Parsons, who was an acclaimed engineer and producer. He worked on...
You just blew my mind. There's a real Alan Parsons.
So he engineered the Beatles' Abbey Road and Let It Be, Pink Floyd's The Dark Side of the Moon, also produced albums for Al Stewart and Ambrosia. And then the other half of the Alan Parsons Project is Eric Wolfson, right? Apparently not important enough to
just you know. Project.
Maybe that's his nickname.
Yeah.
So he was a songwriter and session pianist. He collaborated with Parsons at Abbey Road Studios. Mm. And actually, he managed Parsons for a little bit. And at some point, they decided to work together and create their own stuff. So this album, it's called Tales of Mystery and Imagination. It's a concept album retelling classic Edgar Allan Poe stories and poems. I think Wolfson kind of had this idea already, before, hooking up with Parsons. But let's hear the opening cut, A Dream Within a Dream.
That dream within a dream.
A Dream Within a Dream is an instrumental composition that is based on the Poe poem of the same name. Kind of the theme of A Dream Within a Dream is questioning reality versus fantasy. So it's written by Parsons and Wolfson. It's kind of a warm up to the album, but it features kind of the sound that I guess dominates most of the album. But kind of a mellow vibe, I suppose.
Yeah. The thing I think is weird is since this is a Poe-focused album, I would have liked to have heard some actual Poe words in the first track.
It's funny that you say that. So they redid this album in 1987 or remastered it. Okay. And I think this track features some language from Orson Welles, reading Poe lines.
Okay. That would work a little better, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's an overture.
Yeah.
Right? It like you said, it kind of frames the record, but it seems a little dreamier than dark.
Yes.
And maybe that's kind of the juxtaposition of Edgar Allan Poe. Dreaminess, darkness, never able to completely find the light,
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I guess it's appropriate. I just, like I said, maybe the new version, I only listened to the original 76. I'm interested to hear what it sounds like with some poetry in there.
So the song goes right into, probably Poe's most famous work, The Raven. Very different sounding.
How'd they get John Popper in there? He's a time machine.
No, here's the real Raven. So maybe that's like the real beginning of the album, yeah. I think.
And what's that, 1845?
Yep.
The Raven?
Yep.
Yeah, I remember reading that in like 8th grade. I was really into the Edgar Allan Poe stuff. It seemed the most dangerous of anything they were letting us get our hands on at the time.
Yeah, he does seem to be the thing that boys get into, it's like the cool literature.
Yeah, because it's horror-y and murder-y.
Yep.
Freaking men.
This actually features vocals from Leonard Whiting, who's the actor from Romeo and Juliet. I think that's the version that we probably saw in ninth grade.
The Zeffirelli one or whatever?
I think so. So the Alan Parsons Project, at least on these early albums, it's the two of them, Parsons and Wolfson, but then they bring in a bunch of guests. So you have a different vocalist on pretty much all of these songs.
Yeah. There's something, I dare say it, yacht rockish. I know that this is like prog Pink Floyd-y, but there's maybe because of the vocal choices or the emotive vocals, which a lot of prog of this, like Pink Floyd and stuff, wasn't really soaring that,
Yeah, that's true. I guess maybe it's kind of the Steely Dan thing because
I guess I could say the Steely Dan.
They were progressive in a lot of ways,
but groovy. Yeah.
And so this is, who knows for sure, but this is supposedly the first rock song to use the vocoder. So Alan Parsons' voice there is going, "The Raven." I can't do it. Like the robot voice.
Now do that again.
"The Raven." No, that's
That's Marge Simpson. Yeah.
Homie, the Raven is here.
They did that on a Treehouse of Horror, I think, the Raven.
Yeah, they did.
So, yeah, I mean, it really is what you would expect, I think. So, yeah. Hey, it's a progressive album.
Each song is a different poem or based on one of his short stories.
Yeah, and it's exactly what I would expect. But I think I maybe like it a little more. There's an accessibility, I think, to the Alan Parsons Project.
It's less gothic than I would have anticipated. I would have expected more like Dracula type stuff, and there isn't. It's more modern sounding than that. Well, 1970s right. Modern.
There's a little bit of that, you know, when you get to the orchestral piece, the Follow the House Usher, which we'll probably talk about later. All right. Well, was there a track you wanted to talk about, or a favorite Poe work, maybe that you?
Yep, this was one of my favorites, and I read in that class in eighth grade, The Telltale Heart. Plus, we also like rock a little bit here for the only time in the album, really, when it rocks. And part of that is due to Arthur Brown. He's from the band Crazy World of Arthur Brown. I think we talked about. He has an album and it features a song "Fire." I think we talked about that on Diggin' a while back.
Yes,
he's a British guy. It's a wild, manic performance that kind of narrates or mirrors the narrator's descent into madness. So the story from 1843, this guy murders this old man that's got a vulture eye. Like he gets obsessed with this guy staring at him, and he obviously psychotic, and he kills him, hides him under the floorboards, and the guilt starts eating away. He can't stop hearing the heartbeat, the telltale heart. Keeps hearing it, and it's driving him into madness.
Yeah, classic horror right there.
And you know, a morality tale about guilt and things as well. But the guitar riffs are more aggressive than most of the album. They kind of up the intensity, I think, to capture the violence of the story, because it is pretty violent, especially for 1843. Metal adjacent, proto-heavy prog, theatricality. If the Raven is like sorrow and obsession, which, you know, about the loss of his love and all Edgar Allan Poe's love, the Telltale Heart is just sheer madness and violence, showing kind of the range of Poe's work and influence. So, yeah, it's good.
You mentioned the heartbeat thing. You know, I think it's kind of a nice touch. I think they kind of create a heartbeat rhythm, you know, towards the end. I think it's a pretty cool track. You know, definitely gives the album some energy.
I hear words from the actual story. It's well executed. Arthur Brown, good choice of vocalist on that one.
Okay, well let's talk about the closing cut. Here's To One in Paradise. Yeah, so To One in Paradise is real change a pace. It follows this suite of songs that are that follow the House of Usher, and that suite ends, you know, very climactically, and then this is sort of a relief. It's based on Poe's poem To One in Paradise, about lost love and paradise, and the lead vocals are by Terry Sylvester, who is from the Hollies. They came up recently, right? Oh, because we did Crosby, Stills, and Nash, right? Graham Nash was in the Hollies.
Yes.
This one, pretty different from the rest of the album. More of like a melodic ballad, kind of less prog sounding, I think, than other things. But definitely a melancholic vibe. Kind of a cool way to, you know, end the album, I think.
So that sound, that like angelic sound, is pretty cool. I think it works really well. Like the layered vocals, kind of reminds me of a 10cc I'm Not in Love.
Yeah.
And also, it's got a little bit of an Air Supply vibe to me, which I think is a nice way to kind of end things. I'm not familiar with that poem from 1833.
Me either.
But the themes of loss and longing and desire for eternal reunion and death, I hear that. Ballad-like layered harmonics and the orchestration. But instead of ending on destruction, the album closes in mourning, which I think is a good choice.
Yeah. Yeah, I like it too. All right, well, this is probably a good time to rewind and reflect on tales of mystery and imagination. So I'll start with my clickbait headline. Floyd Engineer and Friends Take Us to the Dark Side to Visit Goth Poet. So, I mean, probably why I enjoyed this album a lot is because it just reminded me of, sure. of Pink Floyd. A lot of it, I think it's the drumming or the style of drumming. It's not obnoxious. You know, it's kind of smooth.
Right.
You know, kind of like Nick Mason does, and it kind of guides you along sort of that dreamlike state, you know, throughout most of the album. And that's, I guess that's just the sound that has always appealed to me. So, you know, for anybody that likes Pink Floyd at all, you know, I think this is a good album for you.
And if you like Edgar Allan Poe, that helps.
Sure. Yes.
Or maybe you'll learn to like Edgar Allan Poe. Yeah, my clickbait headline to describe the album, not just Prague, full gothic cinema. Tales of Mystery and Imagination wrote the book on what happens when rock meets literary horror. So it's a Prague gothic rock opera. It immerses you in that imposed universe. It's dramatic, ambitious, very theatrical, maybe a little too heady, even musically too heady at times. I think they take it too far with the orchestration. Taking you out of a rock album and into a classical album. Mm. It's kind of confusing. But they're not in it for the hits. So yeah, if Poe were a member of Pink Floyd, this is the album they would have made. But yeah, each song is that a little mini adaptation of Poe's works, and it's cool. It's cohesive, even though the music changes quite a bit.
All right. So killer to filler. I mean, I think overall, you know, the album is consistent. The first single that they had released was actually that The System of Dr. Tarr and Professor Feather, which was a cool story that was about, I think, inmates kind of taking over an asylum. It's maybe the other kind of aggressive sounding song on the on the record.
There's a twist in that story that's interesting. Maybe I shouldn't reveal here and let people find out for themselves. But yeah, that song was cool. I wasn't familiar with that particular Poe story either. I mean, I had the giant Poe works of Poe, but I must have not read that one, mm-hmm. or I don't remember it.
Yeah, and we've already mentioned the fall of the House of Usher. So it's five movements, all instrumental. It's not all classical music. So it starts out classical, and then it sort of, you know, kind of gets back into that rock, that smooth rock vibe. And then,
yeah, I guess once it goes classical, though, at least for me, that turned my brain off.
Mm-hmm.
It just became background music.
Yeah,
that was kind of the problem.
It does give it probably the most, I guess it's the most cinematic moment on the record. And that's the one that maybe feels the eeriest or the most like you're watching a horror movie.
But it's one of the most interesting Poe stories, and it's much more deep. And I feel like it's not well communicated. The story is lost. It's just their like sonic feelings about it.
Yeah. That is interesting that they went that. Maybe they just felt the story was too complicated to communicate in a song.
Well, maybe a couple of words in each of the, you know, like character names or something. I don't know. Maybe the trick would be to read that story while listening to that suite of songs.
I kept thinking about the movies from the 50s and 60s, like also all the Poe films that I think Roger Corman was the director for most of those. And of course, it starred Vincent Price.
Right.
So I kept thinking of the fall of the House of Usher with Price.
I really liked The Cask of Amontillado, mostly because I really liked that story when I was a kid.
Yeah, that's not one I knew either.
It's got lush orchestration, so which I'm okay with in this case because we get some moments of that, and then we kind of get some Beach Boys harmonies in there based on the 1846 story. Essentially, a guy tricks another guy into coming into his basement to try this special wine that's so hard to find. He hates him, wants to kill him.
Nice.
Tricks him, gets him drunk, tricks him, and seals him in a wall.
Yes.
All over the cask of Amontillado, which was supposed to be the wine.
Remember that next time somebody invites you to their wine cellar.
Or now it's like, want to come over for a whiskey tasting? Watch out.
So the production.
Yeah. We've talked about it a lot throughout.
Yeah. I mean, you would expect an album produced by Alan Parsons to be well-produced and
cinematic.
Yeah. And it certainly is.
Lots of layers, lots of effects. Ahead of its time, I'd say, to some degree.
Yeah, I think so. Okay. How about replay value?
Yes and no. The Killers standalone deliver narrative punch. But for me, the filler being the House of Usher suite, like I probably, if I were to sit down and listen to this, I'd probably skip that unless I was trying that exercise that I mentioned where maybe read the story while I'm listening to the, but just for listening to songs, the ones that sound like songs with vocals and actual stories, those would be the ones I'd gravitate to. Yeah.
Well, I'll definitely be listening to this again. And I think I'd probably add it to like my October kind of Halloween playlist.
Well, you have your little playlists and stuff. Your social butterfly.
So, legacy, I don't know. I mean, I think it's kind of further advancing progressive rock and the fusion of, you know, orchestral music and rock.
I think more about the legacy of the Alan Parsons Project. Like, they had some minor hits, did not tour, did not promote. He was probably, you know, making a living with the engineering and production. It was experimentation. It was creative freedom. And they were moved to explore Edgar Allan Poe. They did it. And I think the legacy is that the Alan Parsons Project did what they wanted.
Yeah.
And they did it well, and they pushed music forward.
Yeah. And I don't think this is, you know, considered to be one of their best work. So I'm definitely interested in checking out the rest of the catalog.
Cool.
So Tales of Mystery and Imagination stands as a landmark in progressive rock, transforming the eerie brilliance of Edgar Allan Poe's stories into a richly imaginative sonic world that continues to invite curiosity and admiration decades after its release.
Like that? Did you just write your own poem?
I was trying to sound literate. So check it out.
Excuse me. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
It's time again for Deep Questions by Don.
The deeper, the better.
Yeah. All right. So we're dealing with, you know, literature that, you know, turns into albums. What other books do you think would make good concept albums? And what artists would you like to hear do them?
Well, I always enjoy the country music for storytelling, right? And there's a handful of concept album type things and literary albums out there in the country space. But I was thinking about maybe, are you familiar with Louis L'Amour's writing?
No.
Yeah, it was kind of like Cowboys and Mountain Men and stuff like that. So Hondo is a Louis L'Amour book. It follows Hondo Lane navigating the Arizona frontier, gunfights, desert landscapes, personal codes of honor. So I was thinking maybe Ryan Bingham.
Okay.
Gritty voice, you know, frontier themes, natural fit, the Lone Ranger type hero, you know, out on his own. I also was thinking of another Louis L'Amour. Well, it's a series of books, really. It's called the Sackett series. It's about this family called the Sacketts. Obviously, they emigrate from England to America, settle the frontier, and I guess it takes place, all these novels, in 1600s all the way through the 1800s. And I thought maybe Sturgill Simpson could handle telling the stories of the Sacketts. I mean, he did it with the Dude and Juanita, so, you know. Because he can handle the sweeping narratives and character-driven storytelling, plus he would kind of like jump out of the country and go more progressive, maybe progressive rock elements here and there. So I think that could be interesting as well.
Wow. That's a really good call.
I know. I'm awesome. What are you, what garbage are you going to bring? Taylor Swift doing the Babysitter's Club.
Tales of the Fourth Grade Nothing with, yeah. No, how about Prince doing 50 Shades of Grey or something?
Ooh.
I mean, he is a perv, so.
I wouldn't say he's a perv. I think he's just romantically adventurous.
Yes.
Calling Prince a perv. What the hell, man?
I was thinking, you've mentioned To Kill a Mockingbird before. I'd like a modern hip hop artist, you know, maybe like a socially conscious one, like a Kendrick Lamar to maybe turn that into an album, you know, breathe new life into into that novel.
I could definitely hear a song about the busting up the shiffer robe. I think you could go a lot of directions.
Yeah.
I'm not joking. I mean, that's an iconic piece of that story. Yeah, that's good. That's a good one, man.
Thank you.
I underestimated you.
What other books would make good concept albums? Let us know on our social media, like Instagram and Facebook at Album Nerds.
I ended up sticking in the 1970s as well with David Robert Jones.
Davy Jones?
No, not that one, ladies. It's David Bowie, or Bowie. Regarded as one of the most influential musicians of the 20th century. A lot of acclaim for his work in the 70s. But his career was marked by reinvention, visual presentation, very theatrical, stagecraft. It had a big impact on popular music. And he had that period of Ziggy Stardust and Space Oddity and all that in the early 70s. And this is kind of the project where he starts to move beyond that and explore some themes. It's Diamond Dogs from May of 1974.
The Diamond Dogs have struck again.
Ow!
It's his eighth studio album, self-produced, conceived in a period of career uncertainty. He wanted to do an adaptation of George Orwell's 1984, but couldn't get permission from the widow of George Orwell. Yeah.
Apparently, she didn't give permission to anybody to do anything with it. And then after she died is when the movie finally was made and so on.
Yeah, so he kind of had to pivot. So he had some songs ready for that, and he had to pivot and restructure his story. So he kind of blended that with an urban apocalyptic scenario influenced by William S. Burroughs. And there's some characters created, like Halloween Jack and things throughout the album.
I just picture Jack Skellington when I saw Halloween.
Yeah, me too. I do too. but this was like moving on from that Ziggy Stardust persona and pursuing some other concepts and elements of dystopia and glam rock and theatrics and all that. And Bowie played guitar on this one himself, parted ways with the Spiders from Mars, his band from the Ziggy Stardust era. This all happened so fast, though. It seems like it would have been over decades. It was over a course of a few years, you know? So it opens with this spoken word piece called Future Legend, and it's a prologue for this hunger city that's created throughout this story. And he kind of describes it very theatrically. But then we get into the what I consider the actual opening song, Diamond Dogs. We have a little cowbell in there, which I'm always a fan of, as you know. So this introduces the Diamond Dogs gang that I don't think we really see throughout the story. It's just kind of, the story is very loose. I mean, it's basically just about urban decay throughout the record, I would say. Then we get into, they roam Hunger City, a lot of distorted guitar. There's some glam swagger.
Mm-hmm.
Grotesque imagery, describing mutants, decay, chaos, fleas the size of rats, sucked on rats the size of cats, So it opens this kind of world that he's able to freely just toss these apocalyptic songs, including ones that were supposed to be for 1984, into the mix.
Yeah, it's actually, when you listen to the album, you really think you're about to start this journey, through this to this fictitious place. And then it kind of gets abandoned in the middle, So yeah. It does become, it's almost like three albums or three or thirds of albums, merged together. Yeah. But
it works. It's David Bowie. I don't need it to be cohesive. I know that sounds terrible, but the approach to this was kind of, he had all these ideas and it's sort of like he chopped them all up and then mixed them together, like taking pieces and taping them together. And that's how there's a flow, even though it's not like some straight up story where Halloween Jack has some resolution at the end. It's not like that. It's more about urban decay and leaving Ziggy Stardust behind. You know,
it's funny that you brought up the like the cut up method, you know, which is, I guess, was a deliberate, you know, throughout the album. I guess that's something that was inspired by William Burroughs, this like cutting up individual things and, you know, rearranging them and stuff.
Some
and,
particular songs that we'll get into like specifically use that method. But yeah, I feel it throughout the entire thing. The first moment that kind of takes you out of Hunger City is Rebel, Rebel.
Rubble, rubble.
Yeah, I can't help it. Rubble, Rubble remember. Makes me think of Rubble, Rubble.
They should have used that. I mean, it would have been a great McDonald's campaign.
Rubble, Rubble.
Rubble,
Rubble. Eat some more burgers. All right, enough about the potential marketing opportunities of Rebel, Rebel. Instead, let's listen to a little bit. This is Rubble, Rubble. And I'm still thinking about it. So this was the first single, I believe, from Diamond Dogs, often seen as Bowie's last pure glam rock anthem, although I think it's a little more bluesy, stonesy, swaggery.
Yeah, yeah.
It's simple, recognizable guitar riff, very stompy, but it celebrates rebellion, nonconformity, exploring androgyny, not so sure. There's those lines in there about, you know, your mother doesn't know if you're a boy or a girl. I thought that was referring more to that period when kids were growing their hair out in the 60s and 70s, and people were saying all the guys with long hair looked like girls. Yeah. I didn't think it was necessary. It could have been something more.
Right.
But in that time, that was really one of the things the dads were like, you look like a girl, you know?
Yeah.
Which somehow was an insult, I guess. but I feel like it's a rebellion somewhat against being trapped in a box.
Mm-hmm.
Bowie had become Ziggy Stardust in the eyes of the public, and I think he was looking to escape that.
Yeah, and I had read, and there, I think there's conflicting reports on this, but so a couple of these songs I think were maybe originally intended to be part of a Ziggy Stardust musical. Right. And so I think this is one of those tracks.
Could've been,
and I could see the, you know, the Ziggy character doing this. But yeah, it's, I mean, it's the connection to Satisfaction, I think, is so obvious.
For sure.
You know, even the vocal delivery is very, very Stones. But yeah, it's so good. Supposedly the most covered Bowie song ever.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's probably the easiest.
Probably. Yes.
Yeah. So, Don, what song or songs were you considering here? What do we talk about and how do we talk about it?
Yes. Well, apparently, you know, the other album made me into like song suites. So there is sort of a suite of three songs in the middle of this record. So it's Sweet Thing, Candidate, and then Sweet Thing, Reprise. So let's hear part of Sweet Thing. Boys, it's a sweet thing.
That's like, feels like the voice, he's developing that voice that came later and kind of was his voice throughout the rest of his career.
Yeah, you really get his lower register voice in there, which I like a lot. I love that. I think the final group of songs that sort of deal with that original concept album, so I think we're still in Hunger City, you know. There's no more love anymore, I think. And so you've just got prostitutes and you've got, you know, and politicians or, you know, just street hustlers. So,
right.
You know, very dark time. You have Sweet Thing, which is what you heard there. And then Candidate, you know, is kind of a sort of an interesting bridge between the Sweet Thing resolution, which apparently pays homage to cocaine.
Yeah, I think there was definitely some paranoia throughout this record, and I understand he was using cocaine quite frequently at this time, so that could have been contributing to some of this sound, some of the jittery moments, you know?
Yeah. Maybe the first time I listened to it, it didn't strike me, but I do think this is one of the highlights of the album, this little suite of songs here.
I agree. This is where they really do the cut-up method, the William Burroughs cut-up method. So apparently the lyrics were written, then he actually cut them and rearranged them in pieces and then would read the little chunks and then be like, this, yeah, I like this with this. And I think that's why it became three songs,
but they all share DNA because they're all from the same song chopped up into pieces. And it works well in using a method like that, I think shows a willingness to just try anything. Kind of like Alan Parsons Project, but a little more grounded. A little less in the clouds, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's disjointed and deeply interconnected, and it works well. All right, so we close out the album with the chant of the ever-circling skeletal family. Maybe Oingo Boingo should have done this one.
Yes.
All right, let's check it out. Yeah, so it's sort of a, feels like ritualistic kind of finale for Diamond Dogs. Again, those themes of decay and danger and societal collapse are there. We don't hear about Hunger City specifically, but I guess it's influenced by Orwell, evoking the oppression and inevitability of society. Surreal, depicting skeletal figures dancing endlessly. Kind of leaves the album in an unresolved tension. It feels unfinished, which is probably the point.
Yeah, it's weird, you know, so they even cut off the word, like, because I think he's about to say brother, and it's just bruh, bruh, bruh.
Yeah.
And then, like, when you listen to that in headphones, it kind of sounds like, well, as you hear the word over and over, it starts to sound like something else. So it almost sounded like run, run, run.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I don't know if they were running from Big Brother. Or
I don't know what that effect is on the voice with the, it sounds like bubbly almost. Mm-hmm. That's used a few times on the record. I think it's used in Diamond Dogs, actually, as well. Maybe that's how the two are drawn together.
I don't know if that's Tony Visconti helped Bowie with this record. And I think that might be his digital delay thing. But, you know.
Nice. Yeah, it's a weird one.
It is.
But, you know, I think it ends the album well. So why don't we put it all together? Let's try and pack this thing up while we rewind and reflect on Diamond Dogs. All right. For my overall vibe for this album, I'm going to kick it off with my clickbait headline. Goodbye, Ziggy. Hello, Hunger City. Bowie trades stardust for street gangs while wrestling with fame, identity, and the anxieties of becoming his own creation. So the album itself mixes the Orwellian paranoia, Burroughs-inspired chaos, and then Bowie's glam rock persona is thrown in there. And I feel like this is that sort of shedding of skin, you know? The molting phase for David Bowie as he stops being one creature and starts to become a new one.
It must be hard for somebody like Bowie not to have an identity crisis. Or maybe this is his identity crisis, you know? He's always somebody else. And, you know, it's so hard to sum up his career because of that, you know?
I think that was the point.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you my clickbait headline. Bowie tames messy conceptual mutt into proto-punk masterpiece.
Yeah, we didn't really talk about the proto-punk part.
Yeah.
Rebel in particular, I think.
Yeah, probably. And Diamond Dogs. You know, there's definitely elements, I think, that take us to punk. His glamier side, you know, reminds me of New York Dolls.
Well, this album actually felt like maybe London, but as easily New York City, you know, in terms of the inspiration.
Oh, yeah.
In the 70s, a lot of big cities were having financial problems and things, at least in America. So it fits. Killer to filler. I mean, this is tough. It's, as a whole, it's all killer. It's really, if you're looking at the concept or whatever, that's where you can maybe pick something out like Rock and Roll With Me, which is a beautiful reflective ballad, but kind of not tied to anything here that I could find.
I think it's supposed to be another one from the Ziggy musical.
Okay.
You know, so I could, it kind of fits there. You know, I could see Ziggy singing that, you know.
Not so dystopian, though.
No, definitely not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, obviously the killers are like Diamond Dogs and Sweet Thing and Rebel. And there's some other good ones. Don, what'd you have in mind here?
Well, you know, the end of the album is basically tracks inspired by 1984. So I think the first one is We Are the Dead, which is that line, I think, is a direct quote from the book.
Okay.
I like that one a lot. You know, it's one you don't notice maybe the first time you're listening. And then, you know, afterwards, it starts to be a standout. And then, of course, there's 1984, which is just so bizarre. Because, you know, when you think about the subject matter of 1984 and then it's presented in this, like,
Vegas show.
Yeah. Even like Isaac Hayes kind of sounding stuff. Like,
yes. Yeah. Like the theme from Shaft.
Yes. Yeah.
You're damn right.
It is funky and definitely some new influences are making their way into David Bowie's music. Maybe not into what he listens to, but. I think this foreshadows some of what he did with Nile Rodgers later on, mm-hmm. you know, a few years later. And you know, we've talked about on Tina Turner's Private Dancer, she does a cover of it in 1984 as more of a modern for the time, like Here We Are, you know, in 1984.
Yeah. And so then after 1984, it goes right into Big Brother, which is another, you know, obviously, you know, song from that book. The character at the end ends up brainwashed, I think. And so I think that's what inspires this song.
Yeah. And Big Brother's kind of the overseeing political force in the 1984 story that makes everyone basically automatons that can't have opinions of their own type of a thing. Yeah. I mean, it's all there. It's interesting how this was like a game of pickup sticks or something, but it worked out well.
It did.
In my opinion. Production-wise, that cut-up method really comes into play, and I love the kind of raw sound of Bowie's own version of guitar, self-taught. I love the sound. The overall sound, just it all fits together somehow.
Yeah, self-taught, no lessons. Thank you very much, Pop.
It's because I'm the best guitar player in the world.
So it was self-produced, but, you know, with help from Tony Visconti, who Bowie had worked with before, and then many albums moving forward are with Visconti, you know, that whole Berlin period.
Yes.
The Station to Station too. So, you know, an important musical relationship there. And I think Visconti is often known for, weaving in strings and, you know, that kind of stuff. So. He does some of that here, and it's very effective.
I agree. Yeah, it's underproduced perfectly.
Yeah, maybe that just helps it be cohesive because all the songs kind of work together, even though they're not thematically tied.
Yeah. So replayability, yeah, definitely. I mean, on the surface, it's just a cool-sounding Bowie album with swagger and touches of what is to come, you know, as Bowie's journey of performative transformations continues. Full album works best as a narrative journey if you can find it, but it works. And I've grown to love it over the years, and I love it even more having dug in this week.
Yeah, I'll definitely listen to it a lot again. And I guess because it's almost like three scrapped ideas, it does sort of leave the mystery of what would it have been like if he finished the 1984, you know, story.
I think it's better this way.
Yeah, probably.
So maybe it's the best of these concepts thrown into one album. It shows Bowie at a career crossroads, leaving Ziggy behind. The theatrics start to change after that period, kind of toned down, more of a guy playing music for a while in his career after this. So yeah, great legacy, inspirational for other artists and generations of artists to try concept albums and never stop being creative and experimenting in music.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with all of that. It is kind of like a bridge album, yet it sort of stands alone, if that makes any sense.
Oh, and the album cover, we should mention, controversial because it was David Bowie's visage on the front, but on the back, he had a dog body.
Yeah.
And I guess there was a lot of anger because it showed the dog wiener. So I guess they edited that out for a few years on the album covers, but
it is a bizarre cover.
It is. It's very bizarre, but so is the album. I think it fits perfect. So Diamond Dogs transforms dystopian literature into a thrilling theatrical rock journey, cementing Bowie as one of music's greatest storytellers. Check it out.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Okay, so we've had a very, very literary week. Did you put the book down for a second and have a chance to dig any other music?
Not really, but I had already had this one in the can from a few a few weeks ago as a possibility. So it's easy to jump to a favorite band of mine, The Hives. And this is their 2025 album, The Hives Forever. Forever The Hives. They're a Swedish rock band formed in 1993, known for their high energy performances, garage rock sound, matching outfits, you know, little suits. But this new album, The Hives Forever, Forever The Hives, released August 29th, seventh studio album, co-produced by Mike D of the Beastie Boys and Josh Homme of Queens of the Stone Age. Is that true? Wow. Let's check out a little bit of Enough Is Enough. They're grown up. It sounds cool. It's a good album. I've enjoyed it so far in the last month or so. And then additionally, I acquired a bunch of records a few weeks ago, and I'm kind of still getting through cleaning them and listening to them. So added to my collection, Don, this one's for you. Duran Duran, Seven and the Ragged Tiger, released in November of 1983. It's their third studio album. Quite a few hits on this one. Why don't we kick it off with New Moon on Monday? So this was after Rio, right, Don?
Yes. Yep, this is the follow-up. And it's an odd one.
Yeah, they tried to do something different. I think that's probably what made me think of it this week, is they also, not quite as smoothly as Bowie, but they changed sounds and directions and liked to experiment and not just do the same shit over and over again. So I appreciate that about this record.
Yeah, definitely. They're going in a lot of directions there. Probably, you know, there's some literary references throughout the album, and it's kind of disjointed. Actually, yeah, now that I think about it, it is similar to Diamond Dogs in that way.
So what about you, Don? What are you digging?
So you had a Swedish band, right? The Hives are Swedish, yep. Right? So I've got one from Iceland, Of Monsters and Men. Do you remember them? They had a hit called Little Talks back in like 2010.
The name is familiar, but yeah. I don't know the song.
They had a big hit, back in like 2010. They've been gone for about 6 years, and they're back with an album called All Is Love and Pain in the Mouse Parade.
Cool, yeah, sure.
Coming out October 17th, but they've released a couple of tracks, including this one, Ordinary Creature.
A little more mellow than I was expecting of Monsters and Men.
Right. Little Talks was more upbeat and, you know. Supposedly this album is going to be sort of more introspective and emotionally rich. So we shall see. Okay. And then another artist I recently discovered, Kathleen Edwards. She's actually been around for a while. She's a Canadian singer-songwriter, you know, in the alt-country, Americana, folk, rock world. Yeah.
That's my thing.
Well, you did Duran Duran, so.
All right. Fair enough.
This was actually produced by Jason Isbell.
Ah, well, yeah. There you go.
So the album is called Billionaire, and here's a song called Save Your Soul.
Who will save your soul?
Is it? No. Who's gonna save
your soul? That works too.
Mm-hmm. Kind of nice, you know.
I'll check it out.
It's a little, kind of depressing. Yeah. You know, depressing vibe, which I like.
Kind of got a little Chrissy Hynde vibe to it. I like that.
Yeah. So what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky at Album Nerds.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
It is now time on the show when I'm reminded of the words of Patti Smith, well-known new wave punk pioneer.
Mm-hmm.
Please, no matter how we advance technology, please don't abandon the book. There's nothing in our material world more beautiful than the book.
Reminds me of the Chris Farley character that's like, for God's sakes, let the boy
let the boy read the book. With that in mind, let's bring out the wheel of musical discovery to see what kind of albums we'll be talking about, or to find out to see what kind of albums we'll be discovering next time.
Next time, we're cranking up the distortion for a dive into new metal. Born in the late 90s and exploding in the early 2000s, this genre mixed crushing riffs, hip-hop swagger, and raw emotion, producing albums that defined an era of heavy music.
Get out your giant pants and your chain wallets. It's time for some new metal.
Ooh.
I don't think we've specifically done new metal before. Yeah, get that turntable going there.
All right, well, what's your favorite new metal album? What else are you listening to? Email us at podcast@albumnerds.com or follow us on Instagram and our other social media at albumnerds. And visit albumnerds.com to listen to all 308 episodes. And the best way to support the show is to share it. Please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app.
Thank you so much for joining us here on the Album Nerds podcast. We'll catch you next time. Ooh, wah, ah, ah, ah. New metal.
Well, that's good.
Ooh, wah, ah, ah.
So I thought of one other book that would be a good concept album. Everybody Poops, you know, the children's book. And R.E.M. could do it. So.
Yeah, they could.
Everybody poops. Oh, and then you get the part where it's like, don't hold it in.
Okay.
No, we no, it. No, you gotta go.
All right.
Bathroom humor.
No matter how old you get. See you next time, folks.